The next time you're in a data center working on some big iron routers or some core switches, I want you to do something for me. I want you to just swap out one of the line cards, upgrade it for me on the fly to a newer one. You know, super quick, no one realizing it. And that's a pretty ridiculous thing to say, isn't it? But I wonder if that's the kind of agility and speed of upgrade, speed of change that we're heading toward in the service provider networking space. In fact, some say the telecom industry is going through a major transformation right now, referred to as cloudification. And it's not just a buzzword. It actually represents a fundamental shift in how telecom services are delivered and managed. So with me today is Nina Bargesson, returning guest, an experienced network engineer and architect having worked on some of the largest provider networks and content delivery networks in the world. Her recent blog post, "The Cloudification of Telcos and the Evolution of the Telecom Ecosystem," appeared on the Kentik blog just a few months ago, and in today's episode, we'll be unpacking some terminology and discussing exactly what cloudification in the telco industry is all about. My name is Philip Gervasi, and this is Telemetry Now. Nina, welcome back to the podcast. It's been, I think, months since we've had you on, so long overdue. Thank you for joining today. Although I talk to you every single day, personally, because we work together, so we're in the same Slack channels and we're in about 712 Zoom meetings per week together. But for our audience's sake, would you mind giving us a little bit of an introduction of who you are, your background, especially in the context of what we're going to be talking about today on today's episode?
Okay. Hi, I'm Nina. I work with Phil here at Kentik. But before that, before I joined Kentik, I was building networks. I was building the internet. Always worked on in that specific area between connecting the networks that create the internet. It's the peering parts. It was dealing with traffic. And I've done that for ISPs, internet service providers, and I've done it for content. I worked with Netflix when they were doing their global expansion and building the network in Europe and working with all the ISPs about getting the servers into the network. So the telco and internet industry has been my home for the past 20 years. So that's what we're going to talk about today. Well, not my year there, but what's going on right now, right?
Yeah, you know, in those 20 years of experience, that's what's so valuable to me in talking to you today and also just learning from you at work every day. You're not coming at this as like an analyst looking at industry trends. Not that there's anything wrong with that per se, but you're coming at this from the perspective of somebody who's built the networks that we all are familiar with. You mentioned Netflix, and then, of course, if you drop the names of several service providers that you've worked with, I'm sure we'd recognize those as well. And so rather than kind of looking at the latest trends, you've seen the evolution over the past couple decades or so of how the internet has changed, how network operations has changed from a service provider's perspective. Now, I say that because my background is predominantly, almost exclusively, in enterprise networking. And so when I think of cloud, public cloud, cloudification, and we're going to define that in a little bit, I am thinking in terms of like just lifting and shifting resources to the cloud, getting my workloads into AWS or whatever, and then maybe, you know, kind of configuring some sort of connectivity between the two. But that's not exactly what you mean. So let's start off by defining that term cloudification in the context of service providers.
Well, my definition is that when you take some functions or some systems that used to be something like, you know, if you take a telco, like say the BSS system. In many telcos, when I was working at telcos, that was a system that was, the first code was written in like 1972 in Fortran, and it was running on big mainframes. And then they're probably still using parts of that system now at that company, right? But it's when you take either that kind of systems or actual network functions, and you put them into a cloud structure. Not necessarily the public clouds. It could be the public clouds. Like when we call the public clouds, we talk about the cloud providers like AWS and Google and those guys, IBM, Oracle. They're all out there now. or on a new system or software that is built like a cloud that might be on-prem or might be outside, doesn't really matter where it is because it's just running on the cloud technology or the cloud foundation. And then the software that's building the system can run on that. So that's kind of like a very abstract way of thinking about it. But it's so it's in general, it's this net software architecture, which, and by the way, I'm not a software architect at all, but this is this, you know, the foundation of it.
Okay, so when you're talking about cloudification in the context of service providers, you're not really talking about just lifting and shifting whatever applications I have sitting in my on-prem data centers and chucking it up into AWS or Azure. Now, I'm sure service providers and telcos and CDNs, they do that and they have done that for whatever reasons. But really what you're talking about are network functions that typically, traditionally exist only on-premises, but for whatever reasons, we're going to migrate them to private or public cloud and hopefully reap some benefits, some rewards. But Nina, public cloud is not a new thing, public or private for that matter. So why is it that service providers, telcos, why are they kind of late to the game in adopting a cloud strategy for network functions?
No, it's not a new thing. I think it's because basically a lot of the software they're using anyways have been redesigned to support being run in the cloud. So, I mean, it goes away all the way back to the vendors. I was talking some months ago, I was at a dinner and I was talking to some friends who worked for Ericsson like 10 years ago, and they were working on actually cloudifying some of their some of the software that were used for building mobile networks. So back then, so my friend was like, I was talking about my blog and she was like, why is this even a thing? I mean, we did this 10 years ago. What are you talking about? Why is that interesting right now? It's over and done. And I was like, yeah, well, you it's over and done for you because you did the software architecture change back then. But now we get the benefit of it. So it seems like the network, and maybe in particular mobile networks, becomes more modular, and you can have some running somewhere and some running somewhere else, instead of having these hardware that you put together in a backend that, you know, is run and need to be very fixed.
Okay, well, I understand that you're not a software engineer or a software developer, but what do you mean that software architectures changed that allowed certain network functions to be able to move to the cloud?
Well, for one thing is that it can run on if it can run on a cloud, it can run on some other guy's computer, because that's basically what a cloud is, right? It's just some other guy's computer and not your computer, or it could be your computer, but it doesn't really matter. That's the whole point of it.
So in the enterprise world, some of the reasons that folks are going to migrate applications and workloads to public cloud, well, I mean, there's a variety of reasons. It really depends on the organization, but it could be for fault tolerance, you know, hosting applications out of multiple regions, so you have that more that increased resiliency. There could be, the accountants getting involved and they want to see more of an OPEX model rather than a CAPEX model and just buying hardware and depreciating it over time. It could be to make delivery of services faster, so expediting the development lifecycle and the release lifecycle. That's a very common reason. But are those the same reasons and motivations for telcos and service providers, or is there a different reason? Is there a different motivation to move network functions from on-prem to the cloud?
I think it's a little bit the same, but I think the most important thing is that you get things divided into more modular design, where you can pick and choose to run a model from one vendor maybe, and then a model for another vendor, so you get some more flexibility on your actual functions. So everything is not so so tight around the same system. That why my experience in working in telco was that, you know, well, there were 100,000 systems, but there was one system that could not be changed, and that was sort of the backbone of it all, not the backbone of the network, but the backbone IT system that came from that 1972 Fortran code and you know, have been added on and added on, and they have added like all the business and the operational functionality into the same system. And it ended up being a crazy monster that was very difficult to move away from. So that's sort of what I see now, is that people can, I can run some of my provisioning system in a cloud, and then I can still have my old fashioned customer system, and I can have an API between them, or you can do mix and match once more.
Okay, it sounds like the goal there was to improve operational practices, service delivery. So getting some of those applications that don't need to live on-prem into the cloud so they can be, I guess, utilized by multiple teams, you know, just making operations faster, more efficient, because there's certainly a lot of network functions that can't move to the cloud. So I'd love to talk about which ones can and why, of course. But I do know in the enterprise, you know, when we think of modularity, as far as network modularity, we think of different systems. A lot of the time, you know, I can recall studying for the CCNA like decades ago, and you have the three-tier architecture. We have WAN, we have campus, we have data center. You have your access layer, distribution layer, core, all that kind of stuff. You're not talking about that kind of modularity, though, are you?
Yeah. So this is just an observation I made when I did the research for this blog, was that it struck me that because the software systems and the network, you know, the backend systems and everything has sort of been more modular constructed, it was easier now to separate, not in verticals, because before you had a vertical where you would have, you know, the network in the bottom and then systems going upwards, and then you would have the products designed on the network, and then you would have the customer management, and then you would have the customer support, and then you would have salespeople, and it was all being in a vertical. And what's happening right now, and at least part of the telco industry, in particular in Europe, is that they're sort of going, oh, we want to cut it the other way. So they want to build an infrastructure company. And then they want to build a sort of like a product services definition company, or they would just do service definition and customer ownership company, which is then the ServCo, and then the NetCo is the, and the NetCo can even be divided into a TowerCo and a FiberCo, and then the NetworkCo as NetCo.
Okay, I see. So you're not necessarily talking about those big components of the network. You're not talking about modularity in that sense, but more in the functions of the network, like the underlay, the services that we run on top of it. You even made a distinction between fiber, you know, so like the layer one infrastructure as opposed to like maybe your switching and routing infrastructure. So you're talking about modularity in that sense. That makes sense. But of course, for me, it begs the question, why? Why do we want to do that?
So then each of those companies can focus on running and building that company the best way. Because at least what have happened in some of the companies I know is that the focus on running a really efficient network and do investments into the network to make sure that it's also ready for tomorrow is very different mindset that you have to do to create the services that people will want to buy and run and manage like gazillion end user customers. So the idea is to create the infrastructure that runs all the physical infrastructure as one set of companies, which will then operate on a wholesale basis. So they will have a few customers, which will be the ServCos. And then the ServCos have all the customer relationships with the consumers and also maybe with business customers, anything with volume. And then they will have the ability to create new services as the market starts to ask for the new services. And they will less tied down to having what type of network they have, because they can just go and buy the type of network they need from the different NetCos there. And the point also be they don't have to worry about selling to, you know, customer A over in that town. They don't have to worry about, wait, do we have a fiber, or do we have a connect? Do we have a pipe into that customer so I can sell him anything? They don't have to worry about that because they will just buy that pipe from that network that has the pipe if they don't have it themselves. So it's sort of a simplification about what's going on the infrastructure side. So you're not building more than one pipe into consumers. And then, you know, making sure that the agility goes on because you don't have to think about the big and heavy changes you might need to do in a network if you wanted to create new services, because it is now designed in a way that you can easily create new services without worrying about the network because you just buy the pipes.
Yeah, right. And I mean, isn't that the ideal for any network engineer? I assume in the service provider space, but certainly in the enterprise space, is to be concerned with, you know, speeds and feeds and just configuring, setting up and building fat, dumb pipes. So they just get packets in and out super fast. You can put your applications on top of it and there's no reliance. It's just the transport mechanism. But that's not really the reality, especially in the enterprise when we're talking about security concerns and regulatory bodies being involved and various points of inspection and CASBs and overlays and underlays and tunneling. It's a little bit more complex than that, I think.
Yeah, but wouldn't you say then, I'm not completely understanding enterprise infrastructure that much, but when you talk about that, you talk a lot about underlay and overlay, right? So I think the netcos is so much, you know, those are the underlay providers. And there might even be a layer of in the servco that there will be sort of like, we have an underlay product here. And then, oh, and then you can buy this thing, or somebody else can sell you this thing to create your overlay.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, before I left field engineering, if you want to call it that, I was selling and building SD-WANs all the time. That was the hot ticket 5, 6, 7 years ago. And what I was doing essentially was selling you the overlay network, the control plane, the tunneling protocols, whatever we were using to pass your traffic over an underlay. And it was just whatever service providers were in the area, usually who were the cheapest. And all I really cared about were things like reliability. I cared about bandwidth and I cared about latency. Beyond that, I really didn't care who you were. I would do my due diligence sometimes to make sure that, you know, my 3 or 4 last mile providers didn't all converge in the same CO 3 miles up the road. That's a problem. But otherwise, I just didn't care.
And then maybe you would even get an SLA, right? You know, sort of like you can't have copy loss, there's a delay here and there, and, you know.
So then the modularity that you've been talking about and ultimately the reason for cloudification of telcos and service providers is really it's operations focused. It's operationally focused in the sense that it allows kind of like a division of labor. And so now a telco can just focus on just getting packets in and out really fast and not being concerned with things like fragments and TCP resets and things like that. They're just going to focus on that underlay and then say, hey, Mr. Customer, here's the pipe, go for it, right? I mean, that's really the whole point of modularity, is to divide up the labor, focus on that component, and then sell it as a commodity. So one of the analogies that I make, I think like every other podcast that I'm on, and I'm sorry to the audience for doing this to you again, but I mean, I liken the network, or at least the underlay network, the speeds and feeds component of our network, to like the plumbing in our house, in my house at least. I don't really care that much about the plumbing. I care about what it does, which is provide water to my shower and to my dishwasher and to the sinks and things like that. But I'm not so concerned necessarily with the plumbing. However, if the plumbing doesn't work right, well, then, you know, we have a major problem. But certainly modularity and this entire thing is about, I mean, these are typically for-profit companies. So there's got to be money at stake in the sense that this makes them better suited to meet the demands of the market and therefore turn a profit better. I mean, I imagine that's ultimately the goal here, right?
Investors.
I don't understand. What do you mean?
Investors. Like, I think another big part of the split of the different companies is to make the network the infrastructure companies more attractive for long-term investments, like private equity people buying up. Yeah. and putting their money into something, they will get their money back, but it might be a longer investment because we're talking about really expensive gear here. We're talking about, you know, big routers, we're talking about fiber in the ground, which is when you invest in that and you look at that and you build that, you're looking at like 20 or 30 years, lifespan of that infrastructure, right?
Sure. And, you know, typically very long-term investments like that, especially in a commodity market, especially when there's a huge asset investment, I mean, they tend to be a little bit more stable. I'm not an investor. I'm not an expert in that, but that's my understanding. Now, what about servcos? We've been talking about the netco, right? Differentiating between servcos and netcos in the broader service provider world. What does a servco do? What is their function?
Well, they are focused on gaining customers and getting the customers and serving them and creating the products that the customer will want. And they might also be, and they will then also, or they're a big focus and a big thing that's been going on in particular for consumer internet access over the past 10 years have been, you know, well, we don't want to just be the dumb pipe. We need to add content. And if you look at the like the U.S. market, the big internet access providers in the U.S. they're also producing content, right? They're also big media companies at the same time. And I think in Europe, the thought have been the same. And first, they wanted to try and create their own content pipe somehow to keep the American folks out. But then, you know, that was not really successful. Like every 10 years ago, every telco had their own video service, but they don't anymore. Now they're bundling their pipes with the content that everybody want to watch, like Netflix and Disney and Prime. So instead of having a cable TV company, you can bundle your internet access with all these streaming services instead, and you still sell some TV for people. So that's creating like one. That's at least one way of doing it, right? And then also combining, even in the U.S., if you're a cable company, you will then use somebody else to provide the mobile phone subscription, so everybody can have like your phone or your entertainment in the same subscription.
Do you think that separating services like that in the way that you described poses enough problems or sufficient problems? Big enough problems that it maybe doesn't make it worth it? Is this really the right direction?
I think in order to do the focus and to avoid internal struggle, I think actually the separation is a good thing, in particular when dealing with the big content providers who would want access to the network in order to make the other kind of deals.
So let's go back to this idea of the modularity that service providers are embracing is partly as a result of the changes in software architecture that we're seeing today. And what I assume you mean by that is the way that software is written today and how it's distributed and disseminated, how people consume it, whether it be over a network, via cloud, that sort of thing. What is it about software architecture that has changed that you believe is instigating or has become one of the catalysts for this change in the service provider space?
Well, I think the modularity is the key word that we're talking about, and then the scalability, right? So if you have a lot of workloads and you just need to build your own monster system at home to make sure if you can do that, if you can distribute that or you can spin up and spin down, as if you have a non-constant load, which is one of the big things about cloud, right? You know, you can spin the workload up and use that. I mean, I remember we doing that. So actually, Netflix is a brilliant example of if you look at the network part of it. Not the content production, but the network, the content distribution network, is is a brilliant example of a cloud-based service provider. Oh wait, you say, But Netflix has their own servers they put out to ISPs, and that's right, that's just the storage of the movies. All the intelligence and all the customer systems and everything they do that requires any kind of compute takes place in the cloud. And they're a big AWS customer, I think, or they were, so at least I think they still are. And one of the things that they are leveraging of that is the ability to spin up and spin down capacity as they need it. In particular, because they run their system in different regions as a failover. So when you then start falling over to another region because you're breaking in one region, well, you need to be able to quickly spin up a lot of capacity to hold everything that goes on. And then when you can distribute all your users again between the two regions, you mm-hmm. can spin down in some areas. And that gives a lot of opportunities that way, right?
Okay.
So another thing is the APIs, because that enables you to specialize very much on a particular function and then create an API and then, you know, somebody else can specialize in something else, and everything is communicating through the APIs. And we've even seen API companies spin up, right?
So what other network resources are we moving to the cloud? Like, what specifically? I mean, certainly we can't move ASICs and interface level forwarding decisions and SFPs and fiber optics. That stuff is physical and it has to stay on premises. So, you did mention that Netflix operates out of public cloud and it does push policy of some sort down to local resources. Is that all we're talking about, or is there any kind of meaningful network function that providers are getting off premises and into, whether it's their private cloud or public cloud?
Well, interestingly enough, it's happening quite a bit in the mobile infrastructure. So you can some of the controller stuff for the radio network, instead of having that sitting on a box on-prem, you might as well have that on a local cloud. Or again, we are running it on a cloud, maybe a private cloud infrastructure inside your own network. There are some big companies who do that, who sort of made a deal with one of the, I think it's either Google or AWS, or maybe both of them, that, you know, well, here's our infrastructure inside. So, And 5G is a big part of that, right? So you just, instead of you building up your own edge compute or control function for 5G, you're working with, you're deploying a private cloud closer to the edge of your network where that can be sort of aggregated. This is not existing cloud telco functions. I realize that, but it is still a big part of what we call telco today. But you also have, again, the customer control systems, business systems, you know, anything that you, if you run it on a server, you can run it in the cloud. That's basically what happened with the software architecture.
I mean, you can put a lot in the cloud as far as, you know, network functions, now that I'm thinking about it. I mean, I'll go back to SD-WAN that I mentioned earlier. I mean, when I was putting in SD-WAN and designing it and selling it and things like that, I mean, the SD-WAN vendors that I worked with, and I was with Avar, so I worked with multiple SD-WAN vendors. I mean, they hosted all of their controllers, their orchestrators, all of that kind of stuff lived in public cloud and specifically in AWS. So the only thing happening locally was local packet forwarding decisions, but the policy all lived in the cloud. The security policy lived in the cloud. All of our other components and elements that we use to manage the control plane all lived in the cloud. And you think about like route servers, just lives on an x86 server, right? And we can push that out, and we in traditional networking with route reflectors and things like that. It's not like an unusual thing. So there is quite a bit that we can do.
You can also move your packets in some of the cloud. The public clouds are offering that. You know, I read about a 5G experiment that Deutsche Telekom is doing with, I think it's Amazon, where they would have like a 5G site in the US and one maybe in Germany, and then use work with network slicing and all that fine thing And the communication between those two sites would run inside the AWS network and using their backbone instead of the internet or some dedicated infrastructure. So they're even pulling traffic flows into the cloud these days. But I think that's some of the most extreme things. But it is sort of like, wait, what? Deutsche Telekom even have a global network? I mean, and then they're using somebody else's for this. Well, it is an experiment, right? But still.
Yeah, I mean, we're going to move what we can off premises into the cloud. So, you know, whatever makes sense, whether it is control plane activity, just business applications and customer management systems and all that kind of stuff, whatever we can. And you know, one of the reasons that we're able to do that, in my opinion, is because we have very, very high bandwidth, cheap bandwidth, low latency bandwidth available to us now, much more and much more affordably than we ever have before. So it just makes it a lot easier to carry out those functions, not locally.
And eventually you might, you know, there will be definitely be functions that, you know, might as well run in the hyperscalers network because they have the capacity and they will sell it to you. And if you're looking into any SDN stuff where you have a centralized calculation on what the best routes through your networks are, you why not put that in the cloud? Why run that on your own box, right? It's just a completely local packet forwarding. You kind of need to do that physically where the network is, and you know, the fibers are where the fibers should be.
Absolutely, of course. And, you know, I really think that the reasons are to move network functions to the cloud for a provider or even an enterprise are just very compelling. And I do understand that there are certain things that we have to consider now that maybe we didn't have to. We have to change the way we approach fault tolerance and resiliency. And we have to think about security differently because some of our resources aren't under our absolute control in our facility. And so I get that those considerations are there and we have to think through that. That might even prevent certain network functions from being migrated to the cloud. Nevertheless, I think there's just so much benefit in moving a lot of these components to the cloud. And wasn't that the promise of SDN from some years ago? Do you remember? I mean, it was like this idea of disaggregating the control and data plane. And then what we're left with are these much dumber boxes because you only need enough intelligence to run the hardware, to run the ASICs and do the local, forwarding decision making, that kind of thing. Therefore, resulting in a much cheaper box. The control plane is somewhere else on the expensive gear. You need less of it because it's just speaking to all my local devices. And therefore, I have a more composable infrastructure. I can upgrade and replace gear much more quickly and therefore keep up with market demand, new business initiatives, new applications being delivered, new services, all that stuff. And I have to imagine that for a service provider that has an infrastructure that's so physical and so, you know, I can't really touch something because it'll break everything, that's got to be a compelling reason to put as much as you can up in the cloud.
Yeah, I think it's one of the motivations. But then again, it depends on what kind of network you're building and you're looking for. There's also highly, highly specialized boxes in forwarding packets, right? So if it's important to you that you can run really high volume through a box, you know, you might not really want to go with a white box, but you might actually want to buy the hardware that's dedicated for that. But if you can then focus your money on that and then use white boxes for lesser specialized functions, and then you can just deploy your cloud and your cloud software, your cloud first network functions on that. That might be able to that might give you some savings in overall, and then you have the money for the specialized gear to make sure that your packets go where they need to go, if that is
right.
Your priority.
So some functions that we might consider migrating are things like our security, since we're just pushing policy that ultimately gets carried out by the local hardware. We talked about moving the control plane itself, but maybe also some business applications and things like that, which are not necessarily network functions, but they're related to, you know, security tags and application tags and customer IDs and circuit IDs and all that stuff can live somewhere else to be pushed out programmatically.
Yeah. But then a thing like, you know, a carrier grade NAT, you might want to make sure that you get stuff that has the capabilities to hold all that state and switch those packets.
So yeah. Let's switch over to talking about servcos now. And that's a pun was totally intended there. We've been talking about netcos for a while, and you know that's more near and dear to my heart for sure. But servcos are the ones interfacing with the customer, like you said, the end user, the consumer, and ultimately responsible for delivering the service, probably an application, down to them. So what are the benefits of this entire shift to servcos?
Well, I think it's when you're disconnected from a specific network, you sort of get the freedom that you can go and shop for the network and the network types and the network that you need. So that I believe that is supposed to be one of the focuses, and then also on focusing your resources on product development and not so much on maybe replacing fibers in an area where their fibers are now so old that you have to go dig and then all your money will go to that one. So it's, you know, by focusing the money on different types, you get away from the problem where, oh, my old network is going to eat all my money, so I don't have time or money to do good product development.
I mean, it does sound like the benefits are, in theory, very, very similar. Scalability, agility, yeah. You know, being able to go to market faster with new services and products, you know, cost.
Focusing, yeah. The downside, I think, and I fear, mm-hmm. is that the netcos will end up being monopolies.
Okay.
And that means a lot of the benefit of competitions that we've had, which has benefited the consumers because of getting good products and low prices, in particular low prices, mm-hmm. Might go away. Because if there's only one network provider in each area or networks, netco, mm-hmm. You know, who's going to make sure that their price is right? And then if they have high prices, then the resulting consumer product will be high priced. If you're going through with that structure in a market, it takes regulation to make sure that everybody's opening the networks for everyone, but also to secure there is some sort of control on the prices. So you can't go and make you netco, we agree the price is this, and both of us are going to take that, so we're not competing with each other and we're not building into each other's areas. And then you get an artificial high price. So we need to avoid that. So we need some regulatory oversight to make sure that doesn't happen.
Yeah, and then because you have that element of control, it de-incentivizes innovation because it's like, I'm the only game in town, so I don't care. Yeah. And that's both for netcos and servcos, I have to imagine, and for anyone involved in this entire chain.
It is. Mm-hmm. And that's what a lot of the telco regulation is about, right? It is about, competition regulation, making sure there is enough competition in the market so you are not allowing too much of a consolidation to happen. But you have to allow some sort of consolidation. Otherwise, people will go around and say, well, we're too many people. We compete to each other. Nobody can survive. So that's a balance they have to do.
I mean, the amount of money that a netco is going to need to just get up and running, a brand new one, right? To enter a new market, to build infrastructure, physical infrastructure, whether that's like digging trenches and buying an incredible amount of fiber and the technology and the big iron and the high-priced engineers, the amount of money to get up and running as like a netco startup is tremendous. So, you're not going to go into some town and have 200 different netcos to choose from and have that kind of competition, because it's just next to impossible to start up in the first place. And it's not going to be like when I go to the supermarket and there's 12 different brands of chocolate or peanut butter on the shelf that I can choose from.
Yeah, but you can still have you know, when I moved into my, not the place I live now, but the previous place 10 years ago when I bought that, I had four different physical connections into the house. That it was a pretty new house at the time. I had fibers to two different fiber providers and coax cable to do two different companies as well. So at that time, it was four different providers I could choose from to get my internet connectivity. Today, three of them goes to the same company. But it was super easy. It was great for me. It was sort of like, oh, do I want this guy or do I want that guy? I'll just go online and go, please enable this one.
Whoever's cheaper.
And for me, it just comes down to who's the cheapest, right? I mean, it's residential internet connectivity, really. So, I'm concerned with the quality, of course, because I live on Zoom and I stream. I have like eight different streams going on in the house with Spotify and Prime and all the kids and my wife and things like that. And then, you know, as far as the amount of bandwidth, I know that we're network people and we want all of the bandwidth, but the reality is a few hundred megs and you're probably okay. So I'm really looking for who's giving me the most reliable connection at the cheapest price. And in my area in New York, I have three providers that I can get a hardline connection, whether it's fiber or coax. And then there's a smattering of local, regional satellite providers. And then, of course, I can always go to like the Starlink and stuff like that if I wanted to. So I don't have a huge variety of choices from which I can choose. And ultimately, like you said, sometimes those last mile providers are going to converge in the same CO a couple miles down the road on the back end anyway. Not to mention that I'm really not buying anything from the providers. I mean, I'm more interacting with the whole like customer service folks and who do I call when there's something wrong and who's fixing what. You know, maybe they're dealing with contractors. What do I know? And so when it comes down to it, I really am kind of just interacting with the servcos. And that really is an issue, I guess. I mean, maybe that's one of the challenges of this disaggregation of netcos and servcos and others. Who owns what, considering that all these components, they work together in a system, yet the system components are owned by different people. Certainly that's got to be a challenge.
Yeah. Well, you as a consumer will always have to call the guy you pay or the gal you pay, you know, and then they will have to go and, you know, yell at somebody in the NetCo if it's a network issue or somewhere else. So, but that is definitely... That is also one of the weaknesses of this one. I mean, what if when shit goes wrong, where, you know, you have to yell at you, is the guy that you're able to yell at, is that the right person to yell at actually? Or they have to go and yell at somebody else and then it will take you longer to get shit fixed.
I mean, we've talked about the technical aspect of moving certain network functions to the cloud, what that means, what network functions would be moved, and all that kind of stuff. But I really feel like this is more of a business initiative and just a kind of a new strategy of operating this entire system, compartmentalizing it, getting different people and stakeholders involved in ownership relationships and things like that. And I don't know, I feel like that it's not really driven by the technical side, but it really is driven by the business side. Maybe that's how it always is. I don't know. What do you think about that? What's really driving this change here?
I think it probably is what leading it. An interesting difference that I've noticed, I know you're trying to wind down, but I'm kind of missing this point. An interesting difference between Europe and the US that we've noticed as well is that in the US, they're not splitting the companies horizontal, but they're creating, there's infrastructure companies are being created, like more pure. So you have the big four that are everything and they're producing the content as well. And then you've, over the years, a lot of cities have built their own fiber network, or some energy companies have added fiber networks to there. And then there's some private equity is sort of like buying that up slowly, a little bit under the radar, and creating sort of a bigger regional infrastructure companies that is going to start competing with the big four on just selling internet access. And they just keep the focus on the pipe, which is kind of interesting to see.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. So I do want to wind down now, but before we do, I do have a question for you. Now, I know you personally. I know what you do for a living, of course. I know a little bit about your background. I know a little bit about your hobbies and you know, family and things like that. But I want to ask you, if you could do something for a living other than networking, no, let me make that broader, not just networking, something other than technology, if you could do something for a living other than technology, what would it be?
It's a good question. I think there are two things that I might be doing. One would be that maybe I would have pursued some sort of career at sea. You know, sailing. But, you know, since I have bad eyes, I don't think back then that would have been an option for me. At least I didn't think so when I was trying to figure out what to do. But, you know, maybe I could have done that. You know, navigation, you know, sailing, big ships. Another part I think might be energy. Yeah, I come from a windy place, and we are the ones with the windmills. Like, you know, Vestas, is actually a Danish company. I don't know if you knew that. And we had some hippies create some of the first windmills, you know, back in the early 70s. And that's now at near that location. We have one of the biggest test facilities for on land windmills, or wind turbines, I think you call it in the US, right? Wind turbine, yeah. So energy in general is really big. So now, if I was young now, I would go into energy.
Interesting. Okay. I mean, I knew you were going to say sailing. I knew it, you know, for certain that you were going to say that. That's what I expected. But I didn't know that you were going to talk about a career in energy. So that's new to me. Really interesting. Thank you for that. So let us wrap it up formally now. Nina, if folks are interested in reaching out to you with a comment or a question, or maybe to pick your brain a little bit with regard to your vast experience working in the service provider space, how can they find you online?
Well, they can find me at nina@kentech.com, obviously, or on LinkedIn. LinkedIn is probably where the social network I use the most these days. I'm not really active on that X thing. And Facebook I've always kept for just my private stuff.
Great. And you can find me at @network_Phil on Twitter. Still very active there. You could search my name on LinkedIn. Now, if you have an idea for a show, an idea for an episode, or if you'd like to be a guest on the Telemetry Now, I'd love to hear from you. You can reach out to us at telemetrynow@kentech.com. So for now, thanks very much for listening. Bye-bye.